and Camino with Kit Hogg.
Time for some poetry now, and who better to turn to than regular contributor to the programme, the bard Matthew Wolfman. But before we hear from him in person, let's listen to this rather extraordinary poem, his latest, a composition not only surreal, but set to percussion.
The mirror knew. A mirror blinked, the clock withdrew, the ceiling wept a shade of blue. A cactus whispered rendezvous, and time dissolved like sugar glue. A zebra rode a kangaroo down avenues of mist and hue, where jellyfish recited screw you to stars that blinked deja vu. The moon wore shoes of quiet rue, she danced with spoons in a sky askew. The clouds, monks of bold kung fu, perform baptisms in shampoo. I kissed a ghost named Thank You Too. She floated past my lost canoe. She fed me grapes that softly flew, then told me, child, be always true. A doorbell barked, a snowflake grew, a beard of steel like a point of view, and the ground made up of misused glue breathed haikus written just for you. A fountain sang of cashew stew, of tissues torn by eyes of you, while unicorns with eyes that drew wrote manifestos in bamboo. The sun came out in a tutu, she sipped soft rain and sweet fondue, and winked and said, what will you do when dreams come dressed real and true? A thousand fish in a pink canoe rehearsed a symphony that flew and flew. The sky split wide, let insights through, and whispered softly, none of it's new. But still the mirror knew the hue, the one that bleeds through all we do, the thread between the false and you, the ever-living, ever-true.
Matthew Wolfman, welcome to the programme.
Hi. Hi, Kit.
What's the poem actually called?
The Mirror Knew.
The Mirror Knew.
Not a new mirror. The Mirror Knew, K-N-E.
Yeah. The Mirror Knew something. Okay.
Yeah.
So we've got a zebra riding kangaroo. We've got baptisms in shampoo. A beard of steel like a point of view. Oh, that's wicked. Cashew stew, I wonder what that tastes like. 100 fish in a pink canoe. Can I ask you, is there an inner meaning here?
Whatever meaning you wish to put in it.
I thought you were going to say something like that. Yeah.
If you can make sense of it, great. If you can't, well, doesn't matter. Did you enjoy the rhythm?
I love the rhythm.
The sounds, the way the words roll into each other, the bit of music below. I mean, if you want to, I mean, I will explain the sort of origin of all this.
No, let's get the comments from the panel in the studio. Mary Conlon, what did you think of that? Did it sound like rap to you a bit?
A little bit. And I love the rhythm.
Yes, the rhythm works really well.
Very good. And I think, to me, it has the meaning of expression. It's expressing.
Yeah. I mean, the meaning for me is the extraordinary visualizations. Are so rich. Matthew, did psychotropics play any part in that?
Sorry? No, it's just, listen, you know, the origin of this, my good friend Ira Goldberg, has this idea that he wants to do a Dada show up here in our village in Gaussin soon. Anyway, he's booked the gallery space and we have to populate it. And it's his idea about Dada. So I didn't know anything. I didn't even know I didn't know a little bit about the Dada movement. But I looked it up and thought, yes, this works for me because I can... as it were, create something where it could be nonsense or it could not be nonsense. It could be surreal or it could not be.
How could it not? How could it not be surreal? A thousand fish in a pink.
Well, yeah, there are elements of it that are sort of nonsense.
No,
it's surreal equals nonsense. I don't know.
And the imagery reminds me a little bit of Edward Lear, the owl and the pussycat.
Someone might have said that.
Who went to sea in a beautiful pea green boat. But
who wrote Narnia?
Is it Graham Pullman?
C.S. Lewis, isn't it? C.S. Lewis wrote Narnia.
Yes, it's that sort of
imagination. Tolkien.
Yeah, but
has a bit of element, I suppose. But it is. It's I'm trying to. If you're looking for an explanation from me, you're not really going to get one.
No, I gather that. Except,
the brief was, can you do something within the context of Dadaism or Dada?
We need to discover what Dadaism is. My comment on the content, I mean, beautiful visualization, storyline zero. The owl and the pussycat, at least they get married and they go to the land of the bong tree where in a wood a piggy wig stood with a ring at the end of his nose. I mean, nothing like that really happens in The Mirror New, unless it's the mirror that's seeing all these images. The idea of the percussion is really interesting. Was that your idea? Because it works beautifully.
With my third son, Harry, who's a composer, and I read the poem out to him. I sent him an audio recording of it, and I asked him, and I said it's a bit in the rhythm is sort of rap-ish, I suppose. Is there any sort of sound we can put to it? And he came up with this. I mean, at the moment, it's really quite a coarse musical track. He wants to do more work on it, and I'm hoping he will send me a more finished sort of music to go underneath, and I will then sort of re-look at it and read it possibly more to the rhythm of whatever the composition is he might send me. Because the words, I mean, I read it in that natural rap way because the rhythm and the syllables and all the rest of it seem to work that manner. But, you know, like all good things, you can play with form and pace and all the rest of it, and I hope to be able to do that.
Do you hope to be able to do it live?
No, it can be recorded, but I can. But I like live performance. I think poetry works.
Yes, that's my question. Are you going to be performing it live with a percussion section behind you?
Yes, that's the idea.
Right, fantastic.
I love the idea. Particularly this, you know, I love the idea of a bit of nonsense, you know, because, I don't know, people, creative people, there's a tendency to, even comedy, to take, you know, creativity a bit more seriously. It's rather elitist in a way. And the Dada movement, which came out of, what was it, the First World War, was a reaction to, you know, the pain of the war, but also the idea of elitism. And during that time also, you know, the Marxists and movement and the communists were getting going. And most sort of bright people either shifted very much to the left in the way they behaved and performed, or shifted, unfortunately, very much to the right. And the Dada is very much in the left sphere.
Dadaism is not just about poetry, is it? It encompasses a whole range of different artistic disciplines.
I mean, it's absolutely everything.
It evolves in cabaret, didn't it?
It's cabaret, yeah. The Voltaire cabaret. It's other performance, Emmy Hennings, who's German, Jean Cocteau, you know, the French playwright. Who else? Jean Moreau came out at Max Dern's, Man Ray, the He did montages. I think Hans Arp was a painter, sculptor, and a poet. The most famous, though, probably out of this movement, is Marcel Duchamp, who I think you might argue is known for two things. One is exhibiting a urinal in the New York Gallery with the words "Our Mutt" on the side, and he called those things ready-made. I'll give you his contact because I think find what he thinks incredibly interesting. And the other one, I think he was the first. He sort of what did he do with the Mona Lisa? Oh, I know. He took a copy of the Mona Lisa and painted a moustache and beard on it.
Right. Okay.
So he was the first debunker of serious art, and his thinking. Let me just give you. I found something. He was interviewed by Joan Bakewell. Old people will remember Joan Bakewell as a sort of bit of an intellectual, critical commentator on the arts.
Certainly.
In the late, early 70s, still going in the UK. Terrific interviewer. Mm. Anyway, she interviewed Marcel Duchamp just before the end of his life, trying to get him to sort of explain what he did. And Marcel Duchamp could do anything, but his thinking was, why did you exhibit made things like coat hangers and, you know, ready-made items? And his thought process, I thought, was really good, because he thought, well, that idea grew out of just the idea of thought. With artists, the thinking translates to sort of working with your hands. And, you know, what comes out of the thought, the hands, is the piece of art. And then he thought, well, what happens if you were to cut off the artist's hands and still end up with something which is the product of the artist's choice? Since you know, the artist from paint and palette is all about his choosing. It's all about his choice or her choice. And choice is the crucial factor in the work of art. So if he wants to use found items because he cannot paint anymore because he's got no hands, or he's lost his voice, or, you know, then thought itself becomes, so why can't I use ready-made items to express what I mean?
What is he expressing, do you think? Did Joan Bakewell ask him what he was expressing by exhibiting a urinal?
Sorry?
Did Joan Bakewell ask him what he was expressing by exhibiting a urinal specifically, or a coat hanger hanging on the wall?
Well, yes, and that explanation I give you is his justification of art, because that's what he thought at the time. And also the other thing is, it's what the viewer or the toucher or the seer or the hearer, i.e. the audience, think about the object.
Okay, so it's about their reaction. It's about
that's just as important. There was that, was it Carl Andre's Bricks at Tate Modern in England in the 70s, I think, or early 80s, and there was a great brouhaha over that.
Just describe for anyone, Matthew, sorry to interrupt you, just to describe that work of art for anyone who's not familiar with it.
They took a sort of relatively small room, and he laid out basically virgin red bricks in a certain pattern on the floor, and that's Carl Andre's Bricks. And people just couldn't make head and the tail of it. And quite rightly, it's probably quite right that you couldn't make head and the tail of it. But some people found the shape or how it was laid in the idea of a rather elitist gallery quite interesting and fun and stimulating and other things. And that's where the idea of the viewer or the audience or the person looking in is quite important to any sort of meaning of expression.
There is this sense, though, that the artist is simply taking the piss. Is there not?
It's possible. But that would be you as a viewer or a listener's interpretation.
That would be your reaction. Okay, fair enough.
Look, here's another one. There was a, in the early days of the Dada movement, there was a, was he German or Swiss? There was a, an artist called Hugo Ball, I think. And he did what he called a sound poem called Caravane, in which nonsensical syllables were uttered in patterns just to create rhythm and what he would call emotion, but nothing resembling any known language.
Mm-hmm.
Mm. And he dressed up in some strange uniform and stood in the gallery and recited this piece of nonsense. And obviously there was a lot of outrage, but I wonder if you can hear, you probably can hear it somewhere. But it's got rhythm. You know, when you listen to music,
yes.
I mean, music might not necessarily have any meaning to you, but you go along with the shapes and the sounds.
Yeah,
it,
yeah. No, I'm thinking of jazz. I'm thinking of jazz particularly.
I have a question.
Yes, Mary.
Would you think that what Yoko Ono does is Dadaism?
Sorry, say that again.
What Yoko Ono does is Dadaism.
A Yoko Ono.
Yeah, Yoko Ono is John Lennon's. John Lennon's partner.
If you want to interpret it that way, possibly. Mm. I think that's the other thing you shouldn't try and do, which is box art or performance art or conceptual art. Or, you know, people try and, particularly critics, put things in boxes because it just makes, it helps them with their logic. People like to, you know, have drawers where things fit. And the whole point about this movement is it deliberately subverts all of that thought process, which I like. It's quite anarchic. Here's a little anecdote for you. When I was at university, I was at one of these universities called Warwick. I founded the Anarchists Association. And as soon as it was formed, I resigned on principle. Now, I suppose you call that Dada.
Yes, absolutely. Protests against convention are illogical or difficult to understand.
It can be easy. Or relatively easy. That poem I read, or you played my poem, you found lovely, emotional, surreal sense in parts of it, not all of it.
I don't know about emotional. I don't think it was emotional. I think it was sensual, thoroughly sensual.
All right.
In fact, we're gonna hear that again, Matty. Now okay. We've had the explanation of Dadaism. Okay. So if you're listening to Matthew Wolfman and are wondering what he's going on about, we're going to confuse you even more because Mary's now going to play this poem again. The poem called "The Mirror Knew" by Matthew Wolfman. Matthew, stay on the line, please, because I do want to talk to you very briefly about spring flowers, something that isn't probably Dadaism, that is actually out there and real and super definable. But let's hear that. Let's hear "The Mirror Knew" again.
The mirror knew. A mirror blinked, the clock withdrew, the ceiling wept a shade of blue. A cactus whispered rendezvous, and time dissolved like sugar glue. A zebra rode a kangaroo down avenues of mist and hue, where jellyfish recited "screw you" to stars that blinked deja vu. The moon wore shoes of quiet rue, she danced with spoons in a sky askew. The clouds, monks of bold kung fu, performed baptisms in shampoo. I kissed a ghost named Thank You Too. She floated past my lost canoe. She fed me grapes that softly flew, then told me, "Child, be always true." A doorbell barked, a snowflake grew, a beard of steel like a point of view, and the ground made up of misused glue breathed haikus written just for you. A fountain sang of cashew stew, of tissues torn by eyes of you, while unicorns with eyes that drew wrote manifestos in bamboo. The sun came out in a tutu, she sips soft rain and sweet fondue, and winked and said, "What will you do when dreams come dressed real and true?" A thousand fish in a pink canoe rehearsed a symphony that flew and flew. The sky split wide, let insights through, and whispered softly, "None of it's new." But still the mirror knew the hue, the one that bleeds through all we do, the thread between the false and you, the ever-living, ever-true.
Well, thank you, Matthew. I'm with Matthew Wolfman, poet and botanist aficionado of wildflowers. And the wildflowers this year, Matthew, we've just got a moment to talk about them because they have been extraordinary. I've cannot remember a spring like this since the end of the big drought in 96. So tell me, what particular blooms have caught your eye this year?
It begins in November when the lovely little narcissi pop their little heads out. It all begins with the whites, doesn't it, early on? And then that's followed by, I think, the yellows when the gorses and the brooms all appear. And then we go into sort of all the multicoloured stuff. And the lovely cisters, you know, the rock roses.
Mm.
The whites are electric blues, or yellows and purples, and they're sticky, gummy leaves, some of them anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And then wonderful little barberry nuts, the little dwarf iris, you know, the one that's purple with the little purple-blue flowers. And the plant, each plant only seems to last or open for a day, and then it dies off. And then we got the mallows and salsify at the moment, with those vast, huge dandelion heads. They're out at the moment. I love the wild rosemaries and the thymes and the lavenders. And the even convolvulus, that strangling plant. You know, there's a beautiful purpley-yellow one called Morning Glory that's absolutely pristine at the moment. The linseed, the wild linseed, that's out and making a racket. The marigolds. It's just...
What about the one that smells like road tar? The one that smells like a newly laid road?
Daria, I think it is. And it does. If you rub the leaf, you think you're laying tar.
Yeah. It's called bituminaria or something.
Bituminaria,
right.
And there's another one which I love. I think it's the wild carrot. Dorcas carota, or Queen Anne's lace, I think it's called, with this white head. And if you look, huge crown of a head full of it. It's like, you know, it's just gorgeous. It's like lots of little snowflakes under a microscope. And then there's the wild alliums that are out. And, you know, the giant fennel, or hinojo, is it? That I think we might have missed it now. It was a bit earlier. Great yellow crowns. I mean, it's just been extraordinary. And you just walk out, and it's everywhere, isn't it?
Absolutely.
I love it.
It is in the campo, and not so much down here on the coast, but... if you get the opportunity to get into the campo this weekend, the wildflowers are absolutely peaking. They will soon brown off and die. They will soon turn prickly and biscuit brown. So do get up into the campo to see those wildflowers. This is a May like none other. Matthew Wolfman, it's been wonderful having you on the program. Thank you so much for the poetry and the botany. And let's speak soon.
Yep. Thank you, Kit. Enjoyed it. Good luck. Have a great day.
Yeah, you too, man.
And thank you, Marie, as well. Have a great day.
Thank you, Matthew.
Happy weekend. Bye-bye now.
Okay. Take care. Bye.